All right, good evening, everybody.
Hi.
Great job, Janet Carroll. welcome to the Gloucester Writers Center. I'm very excited to have Joseph Tora and Yang Kung Gu here tonight. Joseph Tora is a novelist, a poet, and a friend. He is one of the best voices I've had the honor to read, and one of the best advocates for the work of my work and of the work of poets and writers he believes in. And Yang Kung Gu is somebody he believes in, and I take his word for it. Yang Kung Gu is a visiting scholar from China to UMass Boston. She's in the business department, but while she's here, she's embarked on writing a novel, and she and Joe found each other. And as Joe is a translator of the Chinese, he and Yang Kung Gu are working together to compose and translate this novel, and I'm really excited to let them talk about their process and read from it. Joe and Yang Kung Gu.
I'm going to just talk a couple of minutes to set up what we're going to do. Maybe Yang Kung has something to say too before we start. Yang Kung Gu walked into a Six American Authors class I was teaching at UMass. And by the way, Amanda, yeah, I did a very loose translations. I don't really translate. I don't speak Chinese. I don't read characters or anything. So when I translated my own book of Chinese poems, I was basically riffing off all the great traditions that I inherited over the 20th century. She was interested in American literature. She was interested in improving her English. And so before you know it, we were reading William Carlos Williams' Spring and All, and I noticed she was translating it into Chinese as she was reading it. So and we talked poets, we talked Taoism, and the rest is history. But about last June, maybe, Yang Kung told me she'd started a novel. And I wasn't, and she started to read a little bit or try to translate it into her English has improved so much since then. But, it was first novel, and, you know, usually as a teacher and sometimes of creative writing, you know, you take things with stride. And the breadth of what she was doing just struck me immediately. But having already talked extensively with her, all the great Chinese fiction writers she had turned me on to that I didn't even know, and realizing she'd read, you know, the French, she'd read Dostoevsky, she'd read all these great Western writers, I wasn't surprised that she knew what a novel needs. And it sounded to me like, wow, that's like really something. So eventually we started this translating process, which keeps evolving. The book is in progress, and Yang Kung insists on revising as she goes sometimes. So we were constantly even revising the translations. At the same time, nothing is really final. So everything you're going to hear today is stuff we worked on a bit. And there's different parts of the book that are more polished than others. But none of the work we have, we've got about 130 pages translated.
Yeah. 130.
And about 200 you've written?
Yeah, 240, I think.
240, okay. There's a lot there. There's about half of it's in translation in different stages right now. We started doing this, and we're going to, hopefully you'll ask some questions, but I just want to set this up a little bit. At first, we started using a program. What was the program, a Google or something? It was terrible. I couldn't even believe what it would come up with for these passages because the difference in English and Chinese is so vast. So we would start with this really rough that it was almost like, this has taken too much time just to try to make sense of what the word, the program's doing. So then we just started going by ear as Yang Kung's English has improved exponentially. Right now, the process is she sits there with a Chinese, the characters, her text, and she translates in her best English to me, and I translate it almost word for word. We've learned that's the best way, onto the page, and then that's the work we begin with, and say, because obviously there's a lot more than just a literal translation. My job, I feel, is to try to make the poetry and the narrative and the music, because like a good poem or any novel needs music. The sentences have to be music. You have to find that narrative that has this voice that sings. It's not just to get a translation down. And that's really hard because the sensibilities are also so different between the Chinese. So it's just constant learning process. So it's just a great project. And I'm really glad to be here. What we're going to do today is we've chosen two chapters to read from, just some sections. The book is kind of vast, so it focuses on one family, different generations, but it's also huge. It's got so many different characters. It takes place all over China, from the east to the west, different times, in mostly in the mid-20th century, back and forth. And so we thought we'd give you a little bit of flavor of the main family the book focuses on. Father's name is Haiyong, Song Haiyong. His family name is Song. His wife, Su Hui, and one of their daughters named Meilan. So that's what you're going to kind of hear a little bit of today, just a little taste. Younghang, do you want to add to that or say anything?
Yes. Thanks for Joey, and thanks for Amanda. I'm so happy to be here, and I come here and I begin to write a novel. I'm so happy for that, and when I begin that, I feel I cannot stop. When I meet Joey and he wants to know what I'm writing, I cannot tell because my language is so limited in English. So I use Google. I use Google translate all the 200 page. Then I explain to Joy and a little bit with my interest in that. I'm very happy for that. So we begin our program. And when we begin, then we find, we should continue. That's all. So we just continue. And I like it, and the whole process make me find many things, not only the difference between language, but also the thinking. I mean, sensibility, philosophy, and even thinking. I mean, everything is different. So I think it's very interesting that translating can be in this way. I'm not sure about what would happen. But I'm just trying to explore, and I'm doing my best to make it all out to Joy. And I think Joy do very, very great job on my door. I will say thank you. I appreciate all the things. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. There was something I wanted to say, but I guess it can wait. So we're going to start. This is going to take maybe 35 minutes or so once we start, maybe a few minutes more or less. It seems like the English goes quicker than the Chinese. As you'll hear, the Chinese language is just magnificent, and I don't think you need to know what it means. You'll hear the rhythms, you'll hear the music, the beautiful language. I will read first in the English, and then Younghang will read. So at least you have a sense of what the gist of what she's reading. And then I hope you folks might have some questions, because we'd like to really, we're working a lot on this. We'd be happy to talk a little bit about it, a little more about it. So we thought, just to warm everybody up and to warm us up, there's a song that comes in the book. I don't even know where it is, maybe halfway into the book. It's kind of a traditional folk song, boatman song. And we're going to sing that.
Okay.
All right. Well, not really sing it, but almost sing it. Okay?
Yeah, okay.
One, two, three. Hole, hole, hey ho. Hole, hole, hey ho. All together, hey ho. Lifted hard, hey ho. Left in the rear, hey ho. Work it harder, hey ho. In the middle, hey ho. Stoke the fire, hey ho. Watch your eyes, watch your hands, watch your hands, watch your eyes. Hey ho, hey ho. Watch your feet, watch your feet. Hey ho, hey ho. Now it's home, hey ho. Now it's home. Hey ho, steady landing, hey ho, steady landing, hey ho. Pick up the boat and move on. Come on along, let's go, go, go. Pick up the boat and move on. Come on along, let's go, go, go. Go, 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 go. Hey ho, hey ho. Stroke, row, shout to the sea. Brothers together, shout it out loud. Hey ho, hey ho, hey ho, hey ho, hey ho, hey ho. Hurry, stroke, lay ho. Back home, lay ho. Heat the wine, lay ho. Back home, lay ho. Heat the wine, lay ho. Heat the wine, lay ho, lay ho. Lay-ho,
lay-ho, lay-ho. Okay.
Thank you.
So the book opens with a poem, and so we're going to read that first, and it's called, the poem is called Melon's Song. It took many years to recognize the dream that long occupied her mind, not a dream. Unsure what year or month, certain of late night, first sighting of Haiyang, his hands, a woman's breasts, though Meilan did not know. In the night, white, glittering under the palms, the body naked, strong. At 4 years old, in a trance, in a foreign land, surprised, puzzled. Suddenly, she opened her glossy black eyes. Wilderness night, his handsome face in moonlight, forehead shining, fingers knotted, roots twisting together, knuckles cracking, a dragon squeezing, 10,000 soldiers and horses leaping, rolling, crushing pieces under hips beneath the moon, hooves galloping, muscular hindquarters thrusting. The gaze shifted across him to snow-capped peaks, learning many years later that the house was located at the foot of a snowy mountain. Outside, a field of potatoes. Inside, a kang on which sat Haiyang and Su Hui, father and mother. Children big, small, like potatoes planted in western China. A vast desert lay there, and devil's castles. Wind whistled to swear love, erode them. Trees lived 1,000 years, even in death they did not wither. Roots tangled, grabbing every grain of sand which held the earth's seed, kept its promise. Desolate land, hundreds, thousands of years, people were exiled there. And this is the opening section from chapter one. Also, what we're going to be reading, the book jumps around chronologically, so there's, past, present, different times, places juxtapose up against each other, so it's not chronological. Although there's kind of a narrative thrust that's chronological, the narrative itself is not chronological. Meilan's dream shifted from Haiyang to a crowd of people. All ugly and dirty. Some stood, some lay on the ground at sixes and sevens, some crowded against stone pillars, some sleeping on their clothes, some hardy, some fierce, some tired. Most men topless, baring their chests, showing their dirty broad backs. The mountain snow caps remained, which confirmed that this was a continuation of Melan's last dream. She flew to and fro, studied all the people's hands. None had beautiful breasts in theirs, as had Haiyang. Melan, not yet 5, did not realize that the dream she thought about over and over was actually the beginning of the journey from her hometown at a railway station in a place called D. In her supposed dream, Melan followed a shining, broad river all the way. The river Suhui mentioned many times later, but Melan did not know it to be the same river. Years ago, along this big river, Suhui pulled out a drowning shepherd's son who shook like a bundle of clothes. Suhui said she was washing clothes there, covering garments with smooth round rocks, one white, another blue, leaving them to rinse in the current. Then she removed the rocks, spread the clothes out on the bank, stones pressed against them. Sitting on the bank, she watched them drying, daydreaming, when all of a sudden there was a burst of laughter, and startled, she looked around to find the source of the laughter, but it came from her own throat. She laughed even louder, raised her head, squinted her eyes, opened her mouth, the air in her throat quivering. She saw a bundle of clothes floating down the current. She waded out until it came closer. It turned out to be a boy, about 3, with shining black hair. Quickly, she fished the child out, grabbed him by the feet, lifted him upside down and patted his back, trying to get him to throw up the water. Then the boy opened his eyes. Suhui asked him his name. He mumbled a long list of words. She took him home and fired up the kang to warm him. The boy wore a sheepskin jacket, so he must have been the son of a shepherd. Haiyang continually asked the boy his name, and the boy blurted out strings of words again. Listening for a while, Haiyang finally understood 2 words, Dong Liang. Haiyang asked him the whereabouts of his home, and the boy pointed indiscriminately. Later, Suhui and Haiyang followed him and asked everyone they met if they recognized the boy, but in vain. They went out again the next day, and the boy kept pointing his finger around, which made no sense. He stayed with them, and every few days, Haiyang left his wheat fields and took the boy in a different direction. Haiyang called him Dong Liang, and everyone else called him that too. He became Meilan's brother, Song Dong Liang. Years later, the boy spoke in a male duck's voice. Heaven knows how his voice changed into that of a duck. And he asked Haiyang, "What does Dong Liang mean?" Haiyang asked him, "You see that sky and land? They were once together. Now they are separate. There are 4 big logs that hold them apart, and Dong Liang is one of those logs." The river which had swept Dong Liang away looked so remarkable in that dream, though Suhui said it could sometimes appear clean and shallow. Meilan had been told that her second auntie, Song Ha Yu's wife, died in this river during a spring. Later, Meilan confirmed that at the D railway station, countless people came and went. Many remained overnight, waiting. In the fields of her toddlerhood, outside the Gobi, the sky and earth were wide. She had never seen so many people huddled together. Starting from the railway station, Meilan remained close to Suhui, eyes wide, constantly getting on and off the train. Every station full of topless men. Every time she climbed the train steps, which were half her height, she had to work hard to lift her legs. People rushed around Meilan. Their baggy pants looked like buckets to her. Black buckets coming in, gray buckets leaving, blue buckets coming in, all buckets moving and laughing and talking. Later, on the train, they gathered around for a get-together and gradually grew bored and began to focus on Meilan because of the solemn expression on her face, as if attending the funeral of an outstanding figure, and she at 4 supposed to deliver the funeral speech. The seriousness on her face was out of tone with the joy of the crowd. People roared and laughed as if they were going to take part in a grand party without knowing how many fireworks would be sent off. But Melan did not understand that. Her lips were tight and her eyes were as black and shining as the iron steps of the train. Many years later, when Song Dong Liang set foot on the worn iron steps, dirty as Melan's face, his black leather shoes clean and shiny as the color of Melan's eyes in those days. I goofed up big time, I'm sorry, Yahong, because I was supposed to read the poem, and she was going to read the poem and then do the chapter. So, but that's works anyway.
Yeah, it works.
So now
way,
we'll begin with the poem in Chinese and
okay.
Go from there.
Good. Okay, sorry. It's my turn. 美兰之歌。美兰用了很多年证实，那个许久以来不知从何而来的梦，并非梦。 是他第一次见到宋海洋，不能确切是何年，但是确定在深夜，那手儿一双正抓住奶子一对。美兰一直都没有意识到，后来才明白，这双手属于宋海洋。那奶子在黑夜里，雪白漂亮，闪闪发光，赤裸的健壮身体，恍如异国之地，诧异难解。4岁的美兰。 忽然间睁开乌亮的眼睛，像一个荒野之夜，他英俊的脸庞尽在月光里，额角满是花光，硕大的一双手，盘龙错节像树根，指节咯咯声响，底下似有千军万马翻腾，全部揉碎到他胯下，他胯下恍惚有一匹骏马，骏马在月下耸跃，四蹄驰骋，臀部肥美。 掠过群山，群山高耸，穿过他的双手，美兰看到窗外，雪峰晶莹。那个窗是个土窗，后来证实，窗下有块田，田里面有土豆和红薯。窗内有个炕，炕上有宋海洋和苏慧，美兰的父亲和母亲，孩子一群，大大小小，参差不齐，像他们种的土豆。 这里是中国西部，听说那儿有一大片沙漠，沙漠里有魔鬼的城堡，每天夜里风会去那里，在每座城堡上呼啸，宣示他的爱毁掉那座城。城外的树千年不死，死了也不肯枯，树根盘错，试图抓住每一粒沙，风造爱留下的残渍，诺言的模样。 否则早已无影无踪。据说那里很荒凉，无数年里，可能800年，也许1000年，被放逐的人都送到那里去。在那个梦里，在赤裸的宋海洋之后，不久就闯进了一群人。他们又丑又脏，横七竖八地坐着躺着，有的拥挤着靠在石柱下。 有的睡在自己的衣服上，他们有的精神矍铄，面容凶悍，有的很疲倦。他们大多赤裸着上身，有的袒露着健壮的胸脯，有的展示着广阔又肮脏的裸背。远处的雪峰始终不肯离去，提示美兰这是上一个梦的继续。于是美兰在这梦里飞来飞去，仔细地看他们的手。 谁都没有宋海洋手上那一双漂亮的奶子。未满5岁的小姑娘美兰并没有意识到，她一遍遍搜寻的幻境，其实是她离乡之路的开端——一个火车站，名叫迪俊。先沿着一条宽阔的河一路下去，那河水明亮。苏慧其实后来又多次提起过这条河。 但是无人告诉宋美兰，此河即笔川。有一年，就在这条大河，苏慧曾经捞起过一个牧民的儿子，那孩子被水冲下，像一堆衣服一样摇晃着飘来。苏慧正在河边洗衣服，
先用一块白鹅卵石压住一件衣服，再用一块青鹅卵石压住另外一件衣服，任它们随着水流翻飞，过一阵子取下，摊在远一点的石头上，拿一块白鹅卵石压住，晒干，衣服就洗干净了。苏慧坐在石头上，只管看着变成。此时他头脑里钻出无数个奇思幻想，于是忽然间就哈哈笑了。当苏慧被一阵笑声惊到，他环顾四周寻求来源，却并无一人。笑声原来是从自己的喉管里发出，为此他又笑起来。就在他仰起头闭上眼张大嘴，空气随着喉管抖动的瞬间，忽然间看见一堆衣服摇摇而来，他连忙止住了笑声，淌水上去待那堆衣服旋转靠近，就眼明手快一把拽住，发现竟然是个闪闪发亮的3岁多的男孩子。于是他赶忙把这个孩子捞起来，抓住他的双脚倒着提起来，乱拍一阵，想把他吃进的水拍出来，结果孩子睁开了双眼。苏慧问他叫什么，他说了一长串，于是苏慧把他领回家把炕烤上，很快发现这孩子内穿一件羊皮袄子，看来应该是牧民家的孩子。宋海洋问他叫什么，他依旧一长串一长串地说。宋海洋听了一会儿，最后跟着他念出了两个字，栋梁。宋海洋接着又问他家在哪儿，他一阵乱指，苏慧和宋海洋就按照他指的方向循水向上，跟着他一顿乱走，四处询问，并没有结果。隔一天再出去，他又一顿乱指。孩子在苏慧家住下，海洋每隔几天就丢下麦子地，带他四面八方的去找他的家。海洋叫他栋梁，大家都叫他栋梁。后来有一天，他用公鸭嗓子，天知道他的嗓子为何变成公鸭，问海洋栋梁是什么意思。海洋就说，你看这天和地原来是合在一块的，他们怎么分开呢？因为有四块大石头撑着，你就是其中一块大木头。这条曾浸泡过宋栋梁的河，在河梦里看上去很美丽。苏慧说它有时候很清浅。据说宋美兰的二伯母宋海洋的妻子就死在这条河里。美兰后来证实，在敌军的火车站，无数的人来来往往，许多人会在这里滞留过夜等候。在幼年戈壁外的农田里，天必然宽，地必然阔，美兰从未见过这么多的人挤在一块。从火车站开始，美兰一路上跟在苏慧身后，瞪大眼睛不断地上车下车，每一个车站都有人赤裸着上身，坐着或卧着，每一次爬台阶，这台阶都有他小半个人高，需要努力抬高腿才能上去。各式各样的人像一对对水桶一样挤在美兰身边，黑桶涌过来，灰桶涌出去，蓝桶又涌过来，水桶都会移动，会笑，会说话。他们涌进来后不久就围起来，开始了一场欢聚会。渐渐的，他们觉得无聊，于是把目光集中在美兰身上，因为她脸上的表情是一种不合时宜的严肃庄重，这表情像是她正出席一个杰出人物的葬礼。她将受命至葬礼词，她才4岁，葬礼的讲稿却还没有准备好。人们欢声笑语，似乎是要去参加一场盛会，那等候他们的盛会上将不知要放多少炮竹烟花。但是宋美兰不了解这一切，她嘴唇紧抿，一双眼睛像她刚刚费力攀上的火车铁台阶一样黝黑。很多年以后，当宋栋梁一脚踏上火车台阶，她的黑皮鞋增亮，那就是当年宋美兰眼睛的样子。
I also want to acknowledge Yonghong's lovely daughter, Xinxin, because she's around during a lot of our work. She's kind of our, I don't know, but she seems to calm us down and she's always there. She's witnessed some of what our, we call it quarreling. And it's not easy. And Xinxin's always there to laugh at us and kind of, it's great to have her. This last section we'll read is later in the book, and it starts in one time and then goes into the past. So it starts when Milan's 18, that's the opening.
Joe, can I just ask you something to clarify what you were just... What was happening in China is the exact same thing that you were reading?
Literally, yes. Yes, same story. Yeah, okay. So the stories coordinate, except, you know, we're trying to make it palatable, make some kind of music, narrative in English with the material.
I was just trying to,
it is. Yep. So what we'll read, same thing, and it starts when Meilan's an older, and she's talking with her now, Su Hui, who's her older mother, and then it's going to jump back to when Su Hui was 17 and left home. A lot of this happens in the book, so it's again, there is some kind of chronological arc, I suppose, but it's really juxtapositions of different perspectives, places, and times all the time. It's very modern-esque, I guess, in a way that way. Okay, is this okay? All right. I'm very loud. I was telling Yonghong to project because she usually reads quietly, and I have such a loud voice. When Milan was 18, she suddenly asked her mother why she went west as a young woman. Suhei grinned and began to sing a song to Milan. From the eastern ocean to the western land, from the eastern ocean to the western land, the motherland is wide and grand. It's our honor and glory. Sing with reckless abandon. Sing with reckless abandon. When Su Hui sang the higher part, her voice shook. Milan said, "Don't boast. You must have left because you did bad in school and could not find a job after you graduated." Su Hui sang that song joyfully at 17 when she headed west and boarded a ship with all the other young volunteers. It was the first time she left home, and for such a distant place. The moist air made her feel pleasant. Waves swooped on the great river. The boat struggled against the current, mighty as an army. Su Hui stood on the rear deck and watched the water open up into a wide wake, surprised as the waves lapped the side of the ship, trying to hug her, only to fall back as they drew near. They did not give up, but tried again and again. They tossed and curled, only to fall short. Su Hui felt like a queen sitting on her throne, waves trying to follow her. But soon she noticed beneath the seams of the deck underneath a violent beating and roaring, as if to break through, threatening to drag her down. Her legs trembled, but she stood firm, staring at the deck with frightened heart. "Oh, deck between us, you have no way to catch me. If you don't believe me, just go and try." Su Hui discovered two yellow butterflies flitting around the deck. Such a rare occasion, she thought. The river was very turbid, and she didn't know there could be butterflies. She studied them carefully. They flew lightly, playing with each other. This gladdened Su Hui's heart. Though the river looked so fierce, it could not affect those two butterflies. "If you take a little care, nothing to fear." Suddenly, it occurred to her, why no river gulls around, like she'd been told? The ship traveled one day before it docked on the shore. Mei Lin and a girl named Sui Hua had sat each side of Su Hui. All the young volunteers had been laughing and getting along well. The food was free. Everyone received a quilt, a heavy military green coat, a cotton hat which could cover the ears, and a bag of biscuits. Sui Hua giggled and ate her biscuits right away. Mei Lin soon finished hers. Su Hui ate hers last. Then they began to play with their hats. They thought the cotton hats were very funny. Two young men, one named Wang Gang, one named Lin He, put the hats on their heads and played games with them to amuse the girls. At the edge of the water in the south, the cotton hats were definitely not necessary. They only brought humor. From the dock, they took a truck to a row of white houses facing a training ground. After a welcome meeting, everyone rejoiced. The houses had black tiled roofs with proud warped eaves. Young soldiers ran around the training ground every day, shouting call and response with officers in unison. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 2 days later, they boarded a freight train. Su Hui was unaware she had crossed the Great River. They were heading north and then west. She got farther and farther away from her home. Out of a city, through another city, out of another city, past another city, all the way through the plain until it gradually changed into hills, then mountains. The train stopped with a rumbling thunder. It turned out to be a big city. Su Hui saw two rivers meet in the distance, a smaller one converging into a larger, and the voluminous result ran towards the northeast. The train left the big city and kept to the west. The Loess stretched out, treeless, with people living in cave dwellings. The big river followed them, flowing down from a huge meadow of grassland, running east along the descending terrain, met a mountain and made a bend, changed direction south through a canyon and piggybacked the water of another big river. The two ran together to the sea, carrying yellow mud that they had robbed all the way. The train ran towards the sunset, opposite the river's current. One morning it went past another city, then like a mad bull past one mountain after another that lay in the south, competing with the train all the way. The river, never far away, wound gently, the peaks handsome as men. It was said the son of heaven played with a princess here, and the highest-ranking imperial concubine took a hot spring bath here too. The bull stopped at an ancient city. The women looked around curiously, and Sui Hua, with her sharp eye sitting beside Su Hui, shouted, "Look at the old wall!" Su Hui looked and was surprised to see a man walking on the wall. At that moment, he happened to look back at the train and noticed it starting up to depart. His eyes met with Su Hui's. They were about to focus on each other clearly, but the train pulled away. "The woman is heading west," he thought. As the train moved on from the city, the mountains drifted away and disappeared.
Mei Lan 18岁的时候，忽然问起母亲，当年为何要西行。 Su Hui 笑了起来，对着美兰唱了首歌：“东海到西疆，从东海到西疆，祖国的土地宽又广，这是我们的无上荣光。” 让我们纵情的歌唱，让我们纵情的歌唱。苏慧的嗓音到了高音部分，就暗哑了。吹牛啦，一定是功课不好，中学毕业了，找不着工作吧？美兰说。在欢乐的歌声中，17岁的苏慧跟随同行的人，不久就登上了轮船。这是她第一次出远门，空气湿润宜人。 滚滚大江里，船逆流而上，江水浩浩荡荡，像支军队。苏慧站在船的后舱甲板上，看见浪被托起，拖出一条长又宽的洁白浪道。她非常惊喜，那些白浪花向她迎面追上来，想拥抱她，却在靠近她的瞬间， 被船远远抛弃，但他们似乎毫不灰心，重新追来，却又一次被抛弃在他脚下。于是他们逶迤着翻腾着，苏慧觉得自己像个王后，高高的坐在浪花的宝座上，把一切抛弃，任由他们百般追随。但是很快他就注意到脚下的舱板缝里有激浪正在敲打甲板，在咆哮，似乎狂吼着要破门而入，威胁他要把他拖下去。苏慧瞬间有些腿颤，但旋即挺直，他看着脚下的铁甲板颤抖地想，有着甲板你是够不到我的，不信你就瞧着吧。有趣的是，在甲板边，苏慧竟然发现了两只淡黄色的蝴蝶悠忽翻飞，这可真是稀罕事，他暗自思轴，这江上浊浪滔天，没听说竟能有蝴蝶。细细一看，发现它们飞得轻快，一上一下，互相招引嬉戏，这让苏慧安了心。看来这浪虽然猛，却也奈何不了两只轻盈的蝴蝶，可见只要你稍加小心，也就没有什么可怕之处。忽然间，苏慧又想，这里怎么不见江鸥？就像人们传说的那样，它们是白色还是灰色？船开了一整天才到了岸，这一路上，美玲和另一个叫翠华的女孩子坐在苏慧的身边，众人欢声笑语，因为全程吃饭免费，每个人都拿到了一床被子，一件厚厚的军绿棉大衣，一顶棉帽子，外加一袋饼干。翠华咯咯笑着，她第一个吃光了饼干，随后是美玲，最后是苏慧。大家开始摆弄棉帽子，说这帽子实在是滑稽。两个男青年，一个叫王刚，一个叫林慧，把帽子扣在头上，做各种滑稽动作。在这南国的水边，棉帽肯定是不相宜的，但却带来了欢笑。到岸后，苏慧换上卡车，住进了一排带操场的白房子。一场欢迎会后，众人满心欢喜。这房子有着黑色的瓦片，带着骄傲的俏颜。年轻的士兵每天在操场上跑过，喊着一二三四，一二三四，一二三四，一二三四。两天后，他们乘上一列装货的火车。苏慧没有意识到自己已经跨过大江。他们向北，一直向北，转而又向西。哦，看来自己的家乡是真的越来越远了。出了一座城，又过了一座城，再出一座城，又过一座城，一座一座的过。一路先是平原，渐渐的换了样子，成了丘陵，又渐渐的变成了山。似乎是轰的一声，火车停下来，原来是一座大城。看见远处两条河在这里汇合，小的汇入大的，然后结伴一起浩浩荡荡向东北奔去。火车出了这城，又向西，黄土绵延，没有树，这里的人都住在窑洞里，而那条大河依旧与他们相随。它其实是从一大片丰美的草原上流下来，沿着渐低的地势向东，遇见了山，它就拐了个弯儿，于是就向南穿过一条大峡谷，捎带上了另一条大河的水，他们在一个山口一集，裹挟着一路被他们截来的黄泥，向大海与日出的地方奔去。火车则和河的方向相反，向着日落的方向奔去。在一个早晨，火车忽然间像发了疯的公牛一样狂奔，把一座又一座山瞬间甩在身后，绵延的山峦横亘在侧，始终与这头牛竞走。沿途河流温婉妩媚秀美，飞移的山峰如美男子一样俊朗，据说天子在这里戏诸侯， 贵妃在这里洗了个澡。公牛停在了一座古老的大都城，大家好奇的东张西望。翠华眼尖喊道：“看城墙上！”苏慧一看，哦，原来那里正有个行人。那人此时也碰巧回头看向火车，哦，他看见一辆运货的火车正在启动，他的目光和苏慧相撞，彼此正要看个分明时，火车已经加速了。他驶离了古城，向西出城，山脉渐渐远了，转而就不见了。
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.